This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. British comedian and actor Steve Coogan has appeared in several American films, including Coffee and Cigarettes, Night at the Museum, and Tropic Thunder. He's better known in England, where he's a veteran of TV and film. His most famous character is the self-absorbed and clueless talk show host Alan Partridge. Coogan and fellow actor and comedian Rob Brydon starred in the film Tristram Shandy, a cock and bull story, directed by Michael Winterbottom. Winterbottom recently brought them back together for a BBC TV series called The Trip, in which they play themselves. Coogan invites Brydon to accompany him on a road trip to review restaurants in the north of England. The series has been condensed into a film, which consists largely of improvised conversations between the two comics. Both are accomplished impressionists, and they often lapse into dueling mimicry, like this exchange done in the voices of Sean Connery and then Roger Moore. Coogan goes first.
I'll have a vodka martini, shaken but not stirred.
I'll have a vodka martini, shaken not stirred.
I'll have a vodka.
I'll have a vodka.
You look very worried.
So do you.
No.
You should take a look at your face.
I'll have a vodka martini, shaken not stirred.
You look like you're recovering from a stroke and learning how to get mobility again.
I'd like a vodka martini, shaken but not stirred.
I can feel my legs. It's a miracle.
I'd like a vodka martini, shaken but not stirred.
I'd like a vodka martini, shaken. Not stirred.
I spoke to Steve Coogan about the trip earlier this week. Well, Steve Coogan, welcome back to Fresh Air. I wonder if, you know, because there's not really a story, it's you and Rob in a series of conversations, whether you found yourself wondering, gosh, can I be that interesting? And does it put pressure on you when the camera rolls?
Absolutely it does. At first, I took a lot of persuading to do it by Michael, the director, and the same goes for Rob. It's very difficult to envisage it before you start. You don't know what it's going to be about until you start making it. So there's a certain kind of insecurity that goes with that. But we knew that we were good enough improvisers. My biggest fear, really, was that it would be self-indulgent because, of course, I play myself in it. And actors play my parents, actors play various people I meet. But the only real people are Rob and I. So it's a very difficult thing to try and be creative in that kind of environment. But if you trust the person you're with, the way Rob and I have worked together many times, then we know that when we're improvising, we'll be able to create stuff and come up with ideas. So that sort of takes the heat off it a little. But you need to have a certain kind of confidence to go to places. I mean, when Rob and I were improvising, when you go to places in each other's personality, that can be sensitive. Rob would ask me. Rob and I had an agreement at the outset, whereby we gave each other license to offend each other, as it were, so that we could talk about things that would maybe be slightly unsettling. And a couple of times in the improvisations, it got frosty and it got kind of uncomfortable because we were sort of pressing each other's buttons, so to speak. But that's what makes it interesting, is that there's an edge to it and a discomfort to it that makes it engaging. It's not just... although there's a lot of comedy in it, it's not just a couple of actors saying, get a load of me laughing at myself, you know.
You and Rob Brydon sat down with Michael Shulman of The New Yorker. He wrote a brief piece about this, and he wrote, when comedians get together, they tend to compete, which to the untrained observer can look a lot like funny people being funny. Would you agree? Do comedians compete when they sit when they're together?
Yeah, I think they do. They that is true. I mean, I try to. It depends. If you're in good company, then there's a kind of a, you can compete to entertain each other. But it's a nice kind of competition because the competition involves the competing involves lots of laughing on both sides. I try. I'm not. There are certain comics who feel like they have to be on all the time and being, you know, entertaining constantly. And as you can probably tell from the way this interview's gone so far, I'm not obsessed with being funny all the time, nor am I capable of it.
All right. Well, listen. I want to play a clip. You're a terrific impersonator, as is Rob Brydon, and there's plenty of that in the film. And this is a clip where it actually begins by the two of you kind of having a bit of an argument about whether Wales, which is where Rob Brydon is from, or the north of England where you're from, is sort of more culturally significant. Rob starts impersonating a bunch of famous Welsh actors, and you observe that somebody who's over 40 who has to spend his life doing voices ought to think about himself. And then Rob responds this way. Let's listen.
Well, broadsheet journalists have described my impressions as stunningly accurate.
Well, they're wrong. I've not heard your Michael Caine, but I assume it would be something along the lines of, "My name's Michael Caine."
That is where you are so wrong. And you can look at my live video for proof, because that's the very thing I don't do.
Do you, Michael Caine?
Okay. I say, "Michael Caine used to talk like this in the 1960s, right? But that has changed." And I say that over the years, Michael's voice has come down several octaves. Let me finish. "And all of the cigars and the brandy, don't let me finish, can now be heard."
Okay.
I've not finished in the back of the voice, and the voice now. Okay. Well, I've still not finished the voice.
You're panicking.
Like you're about to bloody talk. Let me finish. Right, so, Michael Caine's voice now in the Batman movies and in Harry Brown. I can't go fast because Michael Caine talks very, very slowly.
Right, this is how Michael Caine speaks. Michael Caine speaks to his nose like that. He gets very, very specific. It's very like that. When he gets loudly, it gets very loud indeed. It gets very specific. It's not quite nasal enough the way you're doing it, all right? You're not doing it the way he speaks. You're not doing it with the kind of... And you don't do the broken voice when he gets very emotional. When he gets very emotional indeed. She was only 16 years old. She was only 16. You're only supposed to blow the bloody doors off. That's Michael Caine.
And that's my guest, Steve Coogan and Rob Brydon, doing a Michael Caine off in their new film, The Trip. That's an example of the film where the two of you get testy with each other and entertain us in the process. And one of the themes of the film is that Rob Brydon, who unfortunately couldn't arrange to be with us in the interview, but he does these impersonations just all the time. He does them when you visit your parents. He does Hugh Grant to his own wife. Is Rob Brydon like that? Is he just so entertained by himself he can't stop?
No, he's not quite. No, he's not. I mean, he can do them, and he does do them, and he is, to be truthful, his real character, how he is in reality, he's a bit more on, or more so than I am, in terms of being entertaining, if you like. But no, he's nowhere near as forced or exaggerated as he is in The Trip when he's doing these voices constantly. He'll do them recreatively, shall we say, from time to time with me. But he would be insufferable, I think, if he really did do that all the time.
Yeah. And do you pepper your own conversation with this? Do you ever lapse into a James Bond? No.
I don't. I try to avoid it. It's a very strange thing. I started out 20 years ago in this business being a stand-up comic doing impersonations. And I really disliked being an impersonator. To me, it was a sort of like a substitute for being talented. It's a substitute for having any substance. It's a trick, you know. It's impressive, but it doesn't mean anything. And I like to have I sort of search for a bit more depth. So it's something I can do. I do it at parties, basically, if I've had a drink.
Okay. You've done a fair amount of work in American movies recently, and I thought we'd listen to a clip from Tropic Thunder. This is one where you play the director of a Vietnam War film that's being shot on location in Asia somewhere, I guess Thailand or the Philippines. And the film is in trouble. You have these temperamental actors, and so you've decided you're going to go out on a limb and put these prima donnas in a real situation and do some cinema verite filmmaking, and you kind of deliver a speech here out in the jungle. Let's listen.
"Gentlemen, I've got good news and bad news. The studio wants to shut us down. That's the bad news. And the good news. If you want to save this movie, you will become a unit. Your objective is to head north to the Dang Quoc River.
Liberate the POW camp.
At which point, volley!
will get himself captured, at which point you will rescue him, at which point we will chopper you home!
Oh! Damn.
Fourleaf, since you're the staff sergeant, there's the map, there's the scene list.
Think you can handle it?
We have rigged this entire Valley of Death with hidden cameras. And I will be shooting as well, from unseen vantage points, so that every glorious moment is captured on film. And believe me, gentlemen, it will be glorious. If it looks real, chances are it probably is. You wanted to be actors? You wanted to occupy the skin of another human being? Well, get ready to occupy the skin of a terrified US infantry grunt surrounded by death, crawling up Satan's bottom. There'll be ambushes, enemy fire, your own little personal slice of Nam. This radio goes to the chopper and the chopper only. The chopper is God, and I am Jesus Christ, his son. You are my chosen disciples. And no one gets to go home till we get the shots. Put on your war faces, gentlemen. Now, let's go and make the greatest war movie ever!
Yeah!
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 Right.
Woo!
Yeah! Yeah!
Oh.
That's Steve Coogan from Tropic Thunder. In Tropic Thunder, the explosion is him exiting the film as he actually steps on a real landmine. this character that you play, this, in this case, very overwrought director, was that based on any directors you've known?
I think lots of directors are. There's a certain, well, yes, there's a lot of British directors like that. They're kind of slightly upper class, really, upper middle class. They have a certain sort of confidence, and I mean, there's a certain sort of innate pretentiousness that goes with being a British director. I'd say, I think there are a lot of British directors who go out to Hollywood and will get a shot with a big budget, and you know, the pressure produces a kind of neurosis. So, but no one's specific. I mean, you can spot various people in it.
Yeah,
I wouldn't libel anyone.
It's the kind of director who isn't sort of directing technique so much as almost acting himself and inspiring his troops. Yeah. Your aspirations for more Hollywood roles is one of the themes of the trip, the film that you're in with Rob Brydon. There are moments where you're talking to your agent in America, and there's a scene where Ben Stiller appears, and I thought we would listen to this. This is a dream that you have while you're sleeping in a British inn, and you see Ben Stiller walking around a pool, presumably in Hollywood, and telling you, Steve Coogan, in effect, that you are a hot commodity and every Hollywood director wants you. Let's listen.
Everybody wants to work with you. I get a call from P.T. Anderson. I get a call from Wes Anderson. Noah Baumbach, Todd Haynes, Alexander Payne, all of them.
They're all auteurs.
Yeah, and they're all geniuses, and they want to work with the genius.
I want to do mainstream movies.
Well, Farrelly Brothers want to work with you, okay? The Scotts, Tony and Ridley, they want to do a movie together. Never done that before. They want to do a thing with you where it's like the future, but it's 500 years in the past, and you're like some guy who's like a warrior that came. I don't even know what it is, but they want to do it with you, okay? It's incredible. Coens calling up. Wachowskis, both of them want to work with you.
Wow.
All the brothers, my man. All the brothers.
It's like
a piece of Coogs.
It's like, I can't believe it's happening.
Well, Steve, guess what? Wake up. Smell the coffee, all right? The dream is happening right now. You're living the dream, Steve. It's all a dream.
Come back. Wait, come back.
I can't. I got a thing, but I don't think I'll talk to you later, but at some point.
Ben Stiller in with Steve Coogan in the film The Trip. Did you write that scene?
I think Michael Winterbottom wrote that scene, and I helped, and Ben chipped in. It was a collaboration. We sort of cooked it up and made some suggestions, emailed them to Ben, and then when we arrived on the day, Ben embellished it. We tried it different ways, and yeah.
You played Hades, the ruler of the underworld, in a film called, was it Percy Jackson, The Lightning Thief, right? It's where he's a bunch of kids who are demigods and they're involved in essentially a modern-day mythology. And you play the ruler of the underworld. Mm-hmm. And you kind of adopt a rock star persona. How'd you come up with that?
It was just the take on it was that the god of the underworld would, rather than being some sort of frightening beast, it might be funnier to make him sort of a British, decadent, louche, hedonistic rock star, a sort of a modern take on Satan, as it were. That's something that people would recognise, you know, because there's so many reality TV shows these days, and you know, we've all seen Ozzy Osbourne, and there's lots of, you know, the British rock star is quite a sort of recognisable cliche for American audiences. So that just seemed a more interesting way to go, really.
Yeah, obviously there's Hades in a mesh shirt and heels and a vest. It's very funny. What's next for you?
Well, I'm making a film in New York with Julianne Moore and Evan Rachel Wood called What Maisie Knew, based on a Henry James' book. And and after that, I'm making a film in Tanzania. I'm writing a Partridge movie, an Alan Partridge movie, which we're going to shoot next year. I'm in the middle of writing that. And involved in the day-to-day running of my production company here, making television comedy shows that I'm not in.
Okay. The Alan Partridge show, of course, was a talk show. Do you want to tell us anything about the movie? Is it about his life outside of the...
Alan was a talk show host in his original incarnation on television, hosting a talk show. Then there was followed by a sitcom about a failed talk show host. And then subsequent to that... we're writing a movie about a talk show host whose career is on the skids, and there's a kind of a siege at a radio studio that he exploits for his own ends. So, anyone seen Dog Day Afternoon? A little bit of that in it, but a comedy version.
Dog Day Afternoon. Wasn't that about a hostage situation?
It was. Yeah.
Okay.
There are hostages in this. Yeah. I think hostages can, in the right circumstances, be very funny.
All right, we'll look forward to that. You know, I wanted to come back to the trip for a second. You have some very melancholy moments in the film, and you know, there's this notion that comics are at their core lonely or sad, and that they've sort of made a profession of their coping mechanism. Do you buy that? Is that you?
I think there's some truth in it, but I don't think it's all defining. I think there's a certain kind of introspection that I have that I put out there. But at the end of the film, you see me arrive back at this very soulless, sterile bachelor pad, which I don't. I live in a sort of a rambling, ramshackle Victorian house. Which is a bit more warm and sort of more family-oriented. So I don't feel quite like that. But, of course, there is a certain insecurity and a certain, I think, sometimes a kind of a malcontentedness that you just channel into your work. Like I say, being creative means that some of these things, that bother you, stop bothering you because the work, you exploit them creatively. So it's a kind of a strange process, but you need to have hang-ups and neuroses to be creative. If you're just in a state of nirvana, you're not going to be very interesting or funny.
Okay, well, Steve Coogan, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks very much.
Steve Coogan stars with Rob Brydon in the new film, The Trip. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. If you were tapped out in Vegas, you might find your way to our next guest, Rick Harrison. He, his dad, and sons own the Gold and Silver Pawn Shop on Las Vegas Boulevard, where over the years he's bought jewelry, gold teeth, watches, power tools, antique guns, and Picasso paintings. Yeah, that's right, I said Picasso. He'll explain that in a few minutes. Harrison's willingness to buy or pawn just about anything has made him a unique sort of pawnbroker, and it's gotten him on television. He and the crew of the Gold and Silver are featured in a History Channel series called Pawn Stars, and he's written a book about his life in and out of the shop. It's called License to Pawn. Rick Harrison, welcome to Fresh Air. You run a pawn shop in Las Vegas. A lot of our audience has never pawned anything. Let's just start with some of the basics. Now, your customers do come in and sell things outright, but when somebody pawns something, what are the rules? How does it work?
It's pretty simple. It's the oldest form of banking. It's been around for thousands of years. Just say you have a wedding band. You bring the wedding band into my store. Say I offer you $100 and you accept it. I give you $100 plus a pawn ticket after I fill out some paperwork. You have 120 days to come back in my pawn shop and pick your merchandise up and pay me my money back. So say you come back in 30 days, you give me $115. I hand you your ring back. Everything's good in the world. Now, if you don't pay me back at all, I end up keeping the merchandise and I put it in my showcase for sale. Nothing goes on your credit report. No one chases you down to break any legs or anything like that. You just simply lost your merchandise. It's that simple.
Now, you make the point that this is actually a banking service that a lot of people really need, right?
Yeah, most people don't realize, I think it's 20% of the adult population in the United States does not have a bank account, and most of them can't get one. They don't have credit cards. They don't have anything like that for, like, when some small emergency pops up. And a lot of people don't realize, up until the 1950s, pawn shops were the number one form of consumer credit in the United States.
I didn't know that. Now, the interest rates, I guess, are high if you calculate it on an annualized basis, right? I mean, $15 on 100 is a lot for a short-term loan.
Yeah, I mean, you got to realize most pawn shops around the country, the average loan is $50. And most pawn shops charge between like $2 and $5 service charge, and they average right around 10% a month. So if you get a $50 loan, it's going to cost you $7.50 for the first month and $5 a month after that. It's a lot less money than if you go to one of these payday loan places. The interest keeps on accruing and accruing and accruing. And if you don't pay them back, they end up suing you, garnishing your wages, and you end up a lot of the times owing them as much as 10 times as much as you gave them, as you got in the loan.
Now, one of the things you want to do when someone brings you something is make sure it's not stolen to the extent you can. Are there particular clues that tell you something might be hot?
I mean, we always ask the questions, you know, where'd you get it, and a lot of other things like that. Most people don't realize how regulated the pawn industry is, especially where I'm at in Nevada. When I take something in pawn or I buy something, I just don't take ID. I take their ID. It's their driver's license number. It's their height, their weight, their eye color, their build. I turn that into the local police department. And then I also have to turn into Homeland Security. It's part of the Patriot Act. That goes to Leads Online, which is put in a central database across the United States and checks for stolen items.
Now, if something does turn out to be stolen, I mean, because when you make that transaction, you don't know, and I'm sure this happens, do you take the hit?
Oh, I take the hit. Oh, yeah. 2 years ago, I took a hit for $40,000 on a set of diamond earrings.
What happened?
Basic procedure. Asked him all the questions. He showed me receipts. Apparently, he'd committed some credit card fraud. I was out $40,000.
So
he just came in the next day and just took them.
So the lady who lost her earrings gets them back. The miscreant gets prosecuted. Justice is served. But you're out the money.
I'm out the money, and it's the price of paying doing business. That's the way I look at it.
All right. Now, the other thing you've got to do is figure out when somebody's trying to pass off a fake. So I guess you get pretty good. One of the things you see a lot is Rolex watches. How can you tell a fake Rolex watch?
It's not as hard as you'd think. There's just a list of things that's right on a Rolex watch that's not right on a fake. I mean, the case has to be right. The face, the dial of the watch has to be right. The hands, the crystal, the stem, the movement. If everything checks out, everything's fine. I mean, in my book, I talk about how this was like 15 years ago. Someone spent, they probably spent $3,000 or $4,000 to make a fake Rolex, and I got burned on that one, so it won't happen again. Someone went out and bought a probably 1970s Rolex. They could have probably got a really beat up one for like $700 or $800. They take the movement out. They went and got a new Rolex face for it, new Rolex hands, new crystal, made an 18 karat gold case and band for it. And they were probably in the watch $3,000 or $4,000, and I ended up buying it for $5,000.
Wow.
It's an entire industry, fake things.
Do you see a lot of fake Rolexes?
Oh, I see them every day. They come in every day with them. And I try to explain to them, why would someone sell you this watch for $50 when they could go to a pawn shop or someplace else and get a lot more? Someone's trying to sell you a Rolex for $50. It's fake.
A little piece of advice from Rick Harrison, right? The $50 Rolex is not a Rolex. And if word gets out that a pawn shop has taken a fake anything, does word spread and suddenly people rush over?
Immediately. I know of a pawn shop where the owner thought he was going to make a lot of money. He was going to start cashing income tax checks. It's like a golden rule in the pawn business, never cash a government check. So he started doing that. Word got out. 6 months later, he realized he cashed $500,000 in bad checks.
Now, why is it a golden rule that you'd never cash a government check?
Well, the problem is with a government check, you can deposit it in your bank account, and all of a sudden, 4 or 5 months later, they come along and say, oh, the check's bad. We're pulling the money back. I mean, so you could literally cash hundreds or even thousands of checks, and 5 months later, you're burned.
That's because the government is slow to deposit them?
No, the government is just slow on their paperwork. What happens is with this particular scam, what it was, is people were going around to mailboxes and stealing income tax check returns. And it was really simple. What they would do is they would just look at the check. Here's the name. Here's the address. They would make themselves a phony ID, put their own picture on it and the information on the check on it, and go cash the check. The reason this person got burned is because he thought he was doing a great thing. All this money was piling up in his account, and all of a sudden it started pouring out 5-6 months later. That's how long it can take the government to realize they've screwed up.
Now, is running a pawn shop on the Strip in Las Vegas different from running one any other place, you think?
Yes, it is. I mean, it's a real eclectic mix of everything I get. Las Vegas is a crazy, crazy town at times, so there's a lot of high-end things I get. So you have to know about those things. You got to know about really large diamonds, really expensive watches. I'm open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. There's the whole problems of dealing with that. Yeah, it's a lot different than most places.
You write that the best nights are fight nights, especially Mike Tyson fight nights. Why?
Yeah, it used to be insane. Well, because what would happen is you would get 150,000 fanatic fans in Vegas, every one of them betting on this fight. And generally, you know, someone's got to lose. And people, I don't know what it is about fight fans, they always bet more than they could afford to lose. They would be lined up down the street to get money.
And so after they lose, why do they come to you?
Because it's usually gold jewelry. A fight night in Vegas, everyone's wearing the bling.
So they've bet more than they can afford. They got to pay.
It's that sure bet thing.
Interesting. You write about jewelry. You say that pimps buy a lot of jewelry and always the real thing. Right?
This is the neat thing about my job. I have talked to every aspect of society in the past 30 years. I have talked to pimps and prostitutes. I've talked to billionaires and everything in between. And I've always been a really curious person, so I just talk to these people. I mean, this was the story I got from actually a few guys that were pimps, and it was, when you get arrested for pandering, that's being a pimp, they take your cash. That's because the cash was obtained illegally, and they put it away for evidence. But they don't take your jewelry. And a pimp knows that if he buys jewelry in a pawn shop, if you bring it back to the pawn shop to get a loan against it, you'll always get half of what you paid for it, as opposed to buying it in the jewelry store. You don't know what you're going to get when you pawn it. So when they get arrested, they will always have someone bring their jewelry down to me. I will loan them half of what they paid for it, and that's their bail money.
Do you have a lot of regular customers?
Yes, a lot of people. I mean, it's really odd. I do have a lot of regular customers. Some of them are well off that do pawn stuff a lot because they go out and gamble too much or do too much of one thing or the other. And then I also have single moms that show up that need that $40 or $50 at the end of the month. I have literally thousands of regular customers.
You know, I think in the popular imagination, a lot of people think of pawnbrokers as, ruthless people who kind of prey upon people in tough straits. I don't.
I really believe we've been vilified by Hollywood, and it's one of those odd things. I don't understand. If you read the newspaper, you watch the news. There's some doctor. He did some very bad things. No one assumes every doctor in the country is a bad person, just that one. But if you see the news where there was a pawn shop owner or something that did something bad, took some stolen merchandise, something like that, it's immediately equated to every pawn broker. I don't understand why that is, but it just sort of happened that way.
You know, you're right about one lady who comes in, pawns stuff, goes out and gambles, but always comes back to retrieve her stuff. And when I read that, I thought, well, you know, if someone is really a steady gambler, isn't the rule, you know, the casino is going to grind you down. You're going to end up broke.
Yes, that's the truth. And I don't understand why some people do it, but I have regular customers. I mean, like on a weekly or monthly basis, pawn the same stuff, pick it up, pawn it, pick it up, pawn it, pick it up. I have customers that if you look in my computer database, have pawned and picked up the same thing over 1,000 times.
Really?
Yes.
Now, the show is fun to watch. The people who come into the show to give you stuff are usually selling, not pawning, right?
Generally, the people who pawn stuff never want to be on the show. And the reason behind that, I find out, is when people are pawning something, they're getting a loan. They have to admit they're broke. For some reason or the other, something has happened or they're financially irresponsible. But the fact is, they're broke. When people are selling something, it's a financial transaction. It's completely different. It's just perceived differently.
Right. So people come to you with all sorts of stuff that they've gotten from a friend or dug out of a basement or whatever. And if they agree to have the transaction videotaped, it might make the show. So I thought we would listen to a clip. This is a case of a guy who brings in a big, like, 19th century coffee grinder. Do you remember this item?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, just describe it if you would.
Good. 30 inches tall. It has a wheel on the side of it. Has a flywheel on the side of it. That way you start cranking, it keeps its own momentum going. This would have been used for like a large restaurant or something like this. And it was pretty beat up and ugly when I took it. And then a lot of these antiques I do get restored, because an old ugly antique doesn't look nearly as nice in your home as something restored and basically looks pretty.
Okay, yeah, and it was sort of a big industrial-looking thing, and I thought we would listen to that part of the show where, you know, the guy showed you the thing, you like it, and now it comes down to a price. Let's listen.
The big question is, what do you want for it?
Well, I'm thinking like $500, man.
Nah. Some people buy it like it's sitting out in their front yard like this, but if you're going to put it in your kitchen, man, or you're going to put it in somewhere nice, it's got to look nice.
Clean it up a little bit. There you go.
It's going to take a lot more than spit. I'll tell you what, I'll give you $200 for it.
That's a quality piece, man.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to have to spend $300 or $400 to get it powder coated and make it look nice.
That's a drop in a bucket for what you'll get for it, man.
But, you know, there's a limit to what I can pay for something. So, $200.
Deal.
All right, come on, let's go do some paperwork.
All right.
And that's our guest, Rick Harrison, closing a deal at his pawn shop in Las Vegas on his reality show, Pawn Stars. So how did that one work out for you?
It actually worked out pretty good. Like that thing I paid $200 for. I think I paid $400 or $500 to get it, make it look attractive again. And
you had to get it sandblasted and painted. Right.
Yeah, and all those things. When it was all said and done, I think I got like $1,300, $1,400 out of it.
So it worked. Now, what are some of your rules that you have for negotiating with customers?
And this applies to just about everybody, especially if you're out buying a new car or something like that. Never give the first price.
And why is that?
Just suppose you're out and about, you go to a yard sale or something like that. You never want to give – you're negotiating against yourself. You don't want to offer someone $1,000 for something when if you ask them what they would pay for it, they might have said $500.
Right. So you might have a really uninformed customer who doesn't realize the value of what he has. And if he says something really cheap, you'll luck into a great deal.
Yeah, a lot of people go with that. Unfortunately, I really believe in that karma thing and that 6 degrees separation. So I've done that before, and the price they've set is way too low, and I didn't give it to them. I actually paid them more. But the other most important thing about negotiating
is... Wait a minute.
Is,
you're blowing my image of a pawn shop owner. You actually negotiate up with somebody?
we actually filmed this. I had a lady come in with a Fabergé brooch into my pawn shop, and she wanted like $2,000 for it, and I just explained to her, you know what? I can't do it to you. I ended up giving her $15,000. You know, I really do believe in 6 degrees of separation. If I did give her $2,000 for that, she would have eventually found out that I ripped her off, and she would have told everybody for the rest of her life that don't go to that store, they will rip you off. And just through that 6 degrees of separation, everybody in the world would know it.
Yeah. So Rick Harrison buys $13,000 worth of goodwill or good karma or something.
and I believe it works because I'm sure that lady right there will be worth her weight in gold in advertising because she will tell everybody for the rest of her life what I did for her.
Now, you know, it's interesting. When you look at the TV show, the reality show you're on, it's not most people's image of a pawn shop. It's clean. It's brightly lit. The counters are nice. The people are friendly. It's a big operation you have there. Now, you close at 9, and then there's the night window, right, where
yes.
It's plexiglass. Is it a different scene then?
Yes. It's the world flips upside down. The weird thing is my pawn shop is located downtown Las Vegas, which is a wonderful neighborhood during the day. It gets bad at night. And people's attitude changes when there's that big sheet of bulletproof glass in between you and the customer. They're more apt for confrontation. And I say this a lot. If it's 3 o'clock in the morning, 3 a.m. on Sunday, and you got your microwave wanting to get cash, you should just go home.
But that's what you're there for.
I know it's a double-edged sword. And I chose it as my profession.
Okay. Now, but you'll buy my microwave, right?
Microwaves I don't buy anymore. They're basically worthless. You can buy them for $29 at Walmart.
All right. But my wife's wedding ring you'll buy?
Oh, yes.
Okay. Now, even if I'm drunk and looking surly?
If you're drunk, I can't buy it off you.
And is that a rule or just your own principle?
That's my principles down at the pawn shop. If someone's really intoxicated or something like that, they don't know what they're doing, they don't know what they're getting into, and I'm not going to deal with it.
Now, is that from experience where you bought something and everybody regretted it?
It's over the years, yeah. I mean, a few guys a little tipsy come in the pawn shop. They come back a few days later. No, I didn't borrow that much. It's an argument. I tell my employees, a drink or two is fine, but if they're got a good buzz on it, it ain't happening.
Okay. Now, what kind of people show up at night? You said people are a little more confrontational. Give me an example of a confrontation.
Remember, I'm the party stopper. You know, if it's 2 a.m., you come up with your jewelry or something like that. No, I'm not going to take it. It's not real. No, I'm not going to give as much money as you want. I've just stopped the party.
Uh-huh.
And it can really piss some people off that were in a good mood, and I suddenly stopped everything. And that happens a lot at that night window. It's been a great 20. I mean, it's been a great time working in this pawn shop. It's amazing seeing what walks up.
Yeah. Do people ever sell you their gold teeth?
All the time. I have the majority of the time the teeth are taken out by the dentist, but my son has a story when he was working the night shift once where an elderly lady came up to the window, wanted a pair of pliers. He figured she car troubles or something like that. And she came back a little bit later with she had actually pulled her tooth to get the money.
Mm. And at that point, I guess you buy it, huh?
Yeah.
And you tell the story of, I'm trying to remember the details, but somebody who would come to you who was like a finance minister for an Asian country?
He would come to town like every 6 months. He had the diplomatic passport. I looked him up online. He said who he was. And he would get broke, come to the pawn shop, pawn a lot of gold, gamble some more, come back, pawn a lot of gold. This would be over a weekend. And on Monday or Tuesday, he would get a bank wire in and come pick everything up.
And what kind of gold? Are we talking about coins, bars? What?
Do you know what Bach gold is?
No.
It's 24-karat gold chains that they wear in different parts of Asia. They call them baht because it's one baht chain, two baht chain. Each baht was 15 grams. They also traded it back and forth as money.
And so,
heavy, heavy, heavy jewelry.
Do you know how this guy got so much gold?
I have no idea. I do know he was the finance minister of an Asian country. Real character, real flamboyant. When he did get his money wires in, not only did he pick up all of his jewelry, but he bought a lot of jewelry from my pawn shop.
Did you ever get something from a customer that you felt you just had to keep personally? You're not going to sell.
Oh, those. I have lots of those things.
Give us a couple of favorites.
I have four Olympic medals that I kept. I'm a big sports. I have a really neat sports collection. I have four Olympic medals. I have four Super Bowl rings. World Series ring, three pennant rings. I have three NBA championship rings.
Now, do you keep this stuff, like the gold medals and the Super Bowl rings, on display?
All the time. It's what keeps people coming back into my store. Before I had the television show, I needed a draw. And that was one of the things, one of the mottos of the pawn shop. We always have at least one Picasso on the wall.
You have a Picasso on your wall.
Yes, I.
Where do you get a Picasso?
people bring them in. One of the reasons I get such odd things and expensive antiques. Remember, wealthy people come to Las Vegas to retire, and retirement communities get a lot of people who pass away. The children come to town, and generally, there's a lot of stuff they want to get rid of. And I have a reputation of being honest and paying a fair price for those estate pieces. So that's how I get a lot of this stuff.
Rick Harrison, thanks so much. It's been fun.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Rick Harrison and his family are featured in the History Channel series Pawn Stars. His new book is called License to Pawn. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show. You can join us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air. Here's George Jones and Tammy Wynette.
In a pawn shop in Chicago, on a sunny summer day, a couple gazes at the wedding rings, their own display.
She smiles and nods her head as he says, "Honey, that's for you. It's not much, but it's the best that I can do."
Golden ring, with one tiny little stone.
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Joan Tuohy-Westman, Sam Brigger, John Myers, John Sheehan, Lauren Krenzel, and Heidi Simon. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.